Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
Barry, because he doesn't think he'll have any time, I have started a stopwatch. So let's talk a little bit about connecting to college students. What I'm going to do, I don't expect to read everything that's on these slides. I put some of my cards up here. If you'd like a copy of the PowerPoint, then I'll be glad to share it with you. I'm going to draw from three sources. One is what is written in the area of how today's college and 20-somethings learn. And I can share with those if any of you want those, some of those textbooks that I use in my work. Also from not only teaching at Freed Hardeman, but also teaching the college and young professionals here, as well as when I was in McMinnville, and actually where I'm going now, put on your mic, and where I'm at now, we are getting ready to start a college and young professionals class. But also, I asked some of the students in two of my classes to share with me what helps them. And as Doug and any of these other guys, Ed and others, would tell you, offering extra credit gets things done. And so I had 31 students who responded to an online discussion thread sharing with me what they like that a teacher does in the classroom. So I'm just going to kind of throw some of their quotes up here. I'm not going to read any of those quotes. They're there for background. If you'd like a copy of it, we can read later. Let's talk about some things they said. The overwhelming thing they said, 18 of the 31 students said, it's all about a relationship. It's what happens really outside the classroom that's the key to connecting to the person who's in the classroom. So I'd say if you're going to be teaching college students, whether it's in a congregational setting or whether even preaching a sermon, if you want them to listen, they need to know you and you need to know them. And so I just think that's really a big deal. They need to know, if you call out their name when they walk around campus, if they are playing in a band concert, or if they're in a basketball game and they see you in the stands, I promise you they'll listen better the next class. And over and over and over, it was just a parade of comments that said, if I have a teacher that I feel cares about me and I can have a relationship with, then that's a person that I will listen to. Also, they talked about a big deal to them was making it applicational to life. They want lessons that relate to their world and give them practical things that they can do. Now, they don't have a problem with learning about history and the story behind the text and context and all that stuff, but it's got to ultimately connect back to their world. So being relevant is really a big deal. Applicational is really a big deal. They don't want just dry facts. And so we have to connect the history, we have to connect the language, we have to connect all of that stuff to what's going on in their lives. And so that's really, really a big deal. Relevance and application are really, really important to them. Relate the past to the present. A lot of students talked about the fact that they like if you give a little bit of historical background. But what they ultimately want to know is, how is that background like my world? And help them to dive into the text. As one student here put it, bring the text to life. And I think that's really a big deal. Help them become a part of the story. So if you're going to tell a story from the life of Christ in Matthew or any of the Gospels, don't just tell them the facts of the story. Help them to enter into the mind and heart of the people that are in the story. Okay? And so whatever story that may be, I need to be thinking, what is Jesus possibly thinking at this moment? Or if I'm in John and I'm looking at the woman at the well, what was her culture like and what is she thinking as she's having that conversation? One of the things we emphasize is before we'll ever get the Word into our lives, we've got to become a part of the Word. In other words, if we enter the story, then the story will enter us. And so I find with young folks, college students in particular, if you can help them to make the story come to life. Don't just tell them what it was like in the first century. Tell them how that relates to what it's like in the 21st century. We talked about relationship, and so I won't rehash that. Connected to relationship is over and over they said, we want a teacher who is real, who is genuine, who is not just reading things off of a piece of paper. They talked about the fact that eye contact is a big thing, that if you stand up there and just stare at a piece of paper during the classroom, it doesn't work. They want you to look them in the eyes. They want to feel your passion and your enthusiasm. As you can see, one of the girls said, just to be frankly honest, we're tired most of the time when we come in the classroom, and your passion is what keeps us going. They like stories from our lives. They want to see how we've struggled with the very text we're wrestling with. And so if Doug is teaching some of these passages and struggling with them, it helps them to know that Doug says, you know, I have to kind of work through this. I have to wrestle with this. I struggle with what to do with this. Or I struggle to live it out. That's powerful to them. It makes us personal. It makes the message personal. So, first of all, relate it to life. Second of all, build a relationship and share a part of ourselves and our passions in the classroom. Also, use variety, and that's a big deal. One research book I read on generational learning styles talks about when you're dealing with college age and 20-somethings, you need to change what you're doing in the classroom about every 20 minutes. Now, I don't know that I always do that, but I try to change it as much as I can because the more you can change it, the more they're connected. And so we try to use a wide variety of things. A lot of them talk about that they like PowerPoints, but they don't want just plain background PowerPoints. They want PowerPoints that pop, that are very visually attractive. And so we use Graceway Media at Freed Hardeman for our backgrounds. They do the same thing here at Graymere. I use video clips a lot, not only video clips from movies. Actually, there's something called wingclips.com that I keep a subscription to. We can get 2 to 3 minute clips, and I often use those at the beginning of class to create a conversation. I may use a picture. It may be a picture from Fox News site of some big accident or earthquake that's happened somewhere in the world, and we use that as a discussion starter. We'll do interactive in-class things. We'll break into groups, talk about something, come back together. Sometimes in our Acts class, we always every time do a skit on Acts chapter 24. We use online assignments. Okay, everybody pull out their computers. You got 20 minutes. I need this, this, and this on Ephesians. I need 8 facts. I need 3 pictures. We come back together in a moment. We're going to talk about what each other found. But the key is a lot of interaction. And a lot of variety is a big deal. They're technology driven. They're visually driven. But also sometimes you need to be unplugged. What I found is a lot of them say, hey, I like PowerPoint, I like visual, but sometimes I just get overloaded. And I had 2 or 3 students say, I just like sometimes where the teacher just grabs the Bible and leaves the PowerPoint off and just talks. And so you kind of need to turn the amplifiers off as we talk about bands sometimes being unplugged. That we need to unplug and just sit down with them. That's a part of the variety. Sometimes a lot of us will just take them out of the normal classroom. And you can do that on a Sunday morning. Just go out and sit under a tree and everybody's got their Bibles and talk. That's a part of that variety. Realize that they are different, and that was heard from a lot of them. On the one hand, they said, we're not fully incorporated in family life. Some of them were frustrated. They said, anytime there's a college class, they talk to us about marriage and family. And we're going to be there, and we need to hear that sometimes. They just said, not all the time. And they said, don't just kill us with Greek and Hebrew and all of those kinds of things. We need that stuff, but that's not where we live. Because most of the ones we deal with, they're not Bible majors, at least my students aren't always. And who you're going to be teaching in the church is the same way. But they said on one hand, and that's on one hand, but on the other hand, they said, we're not in high school. And they a lot of them were frustrated. They felt like their lessons were just rehashed high school Bible classes. And they said, we want something deeper than what we had in high school. And we want to be challenged with something to take home. Another thing that they talked about was they wanted, with that, getting something deeper. Several of them talked about they like it when a teacher presents multiple sides of an argument and lets them wrestle with it in class and gives them an open environment where they can share how they feel without being gunned down. And several of them talk about, you know, a teacher will say, let's talk about it. And then if I say something that's not his party line, then I get gunned down and then nobody talks anymore. And I don't think the student's necessarily saying that we can't arrive at truth, but what several students are saying is, I want to feel like we can think out loud and work through this together, and the teacher will let us share what we're struggling with, and then help us kindly to work through the process of figuring out what the text means and how we apply it to our lives. They like to see the big picture. How does it fit into the big picture of Scripture? You know, a lot of times we get so focused on one verse or a few verses around it that we don't step back enough and give them the blimp's eye view. And a lot of them are saying, give me the big picture of what's going on in Scripture and how it all ties together. Several of them talked about they like organizing and systematizing walking through the text. Because they said it just becomes overwhelming to us. So if you're going to teach me Colossians, help me to understand why did Paul write it this way, and how does this lead into this, and why does this look like it has nothing to do with what's before it? Give me an organized and simple way that I can understand it. College students like structure. They're big on learning structure. They want to know exactly what's expected of them and exactly what's going to happen in the class. They are community learners. They learn better together than they do individually. So anytime in the classroom you can get them doing things together collectively, that's a good thing. Connect to their talents and interests. In other words, if I've got a classroom, and if you've got a classroom, you've got young people from various backgrounds. So if you've got an engineering student, you've got a nursing student, whatever their background is, connect to that as much as you can. So anytime I'm dealing with a passage that connects to one of those, I want to bring them into that conversation. When they do honors papers, let's say they're going to do an honors paper over the book of Acts, I'll say, tell me what your major is. All right, let's find a way to study Acts that ties into your major. All right, so I'm a medical student. Great. Luke happened to be a doctor. I want you to write me an honors paper on what medical practice was like in Luke's day, what kind of training he would have had, and how that would have assisted him in writing the book of Acts. If you can connect it to their talents and let them share those things in class, then they're much more connected to what we're learning about Scripture. But really, in the end, they said it's about a relationship, about relating yourself and relating to our world, and passion in what we share. All right, Kirk, you got your mic. I might need that in there.
Well, I have been asked to talk about what to remember when planning out a sermon series on Matthew and preaching the gospel. And I'm going to quickly run through just a few things that as I approach the text and some of the things that I really keep in mind. And I'm going to overlap with some of the things Kirk said, and I know I'm going to overlap with some of the things Sellers and Barry says. One is, I never, ever, 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 ever forget, that people really do like to go below the surface. People really do. People like to be challenged. People like to learn. People want to get something. They want to hear something. They want to be able to chew on something. And so I'm always, anytime that I'm opening the text, I'm remembering that. And so I'm going to dig into the study and I'm going to give them something. How I typically approach it, as I'm reading through, say, Matthew, and I'm going to prepare, I've got a series that I'm working on, I will read it through the eyes. I grew up studying under Harvey Floyd at Lipscomb. He's retired now. He was a Greek professor, a New Testament professor. An amazing man, and his approach, and Kirk, I don't know if you had him quite a bit, probably at Lipscomb too, we were there at the same time. He kind of used the rabbinical method a lot. And so basically what that was, he let the students basically drive the discussion. It was, okay, when we come in tomorrow, you know, it's Matthew chapter 2, everybody in the class bring three questions, submit written questions on Matthew chapter 2. And so he's got 20 people submitting three questions, and he's got about 60 questions. And these are questions that people want to know. And so basically that would drive the discussion. And it was fantastic. I just loved it, learned so much. But when I'm reading through the text, I'm kind of taking that approach. I'm sitting down and I'm saying, you know, what am I interested in knowing? Is there something, as Doug, I just love the difficult passages discussion that he led us in. You know, see things that just trigger faults. And so I'm going to work those in, because usually if I have a question about the text, somebody else is going to have a question about the text. And so people want those answers. And so people want to dig deeper. It's just the nature of people, and I really don't forget that. And so I'm going to really, really study. And when I talk about really, really studying, then I can never overstate the need for quality resources. And I'm a guy, personally, the way I like to do it is I like to get about 6 or 7 quality resources, commentaries, usually, not always commentaries, but typically 6 or 7 high quality ones, with Matthew, R.T. France, Morris, Leon Morris, D.A. Carson and Expositors, Leon Morris and Pillar, Those are some real scholarly resources that are good, but also I think in a lot of great application points to it. Sellers has a great two-volume commentary of the Truth for Today series. I've really been impressed by that, and I'm sure a lot of you guys have too. And you've got things like that. The one of the NIV, the College Press NIV series, is an outstanding commentary. There's a lot of folks who say, I really don't have the time to wade through that many, so I like to try to do two. Well, okay. I think you need to make the time to really try, because again, I think people are looking, they're really wanting to go below the surface, they're wanting to be challenged, and I just strongly recommend that the priority for us as preachers is the ministry of the Word. And so we really need to find that time and have plenty of good tools as we're setting down to deal with the text. And so I'm going to have several good tools in front of me. Not just one or two, but I'm going to have six or seven. Another thing that I do is I try to get reasonable bites. I love to preach through books. It's just what I do on Sunday morning typically. I'm actually doing it on Sunday night now. We do what we call Sunday night seminars, which is a little different. I use PowerPoint and kind of fill in blank things on Sunday night. I'm low tech on Sunday morning. I don't use PowerPoint or anything. And I'm doing Revelation on Sunday night. And we're in chapter 11. I'm at about the 26th sermon on that. I love to do long series that work my way. I did that through Matthew once. And I had 134 sermons that went through Matthew. I don't know if I really recommend that now. If you do the math, that's about 3 years. And assuming that you're going to be gone 6 or 7 weeks. Did the people get tired of it? I really don't think so. Now, I'm sure there were some there who did. But generally, overall, there was a lot of good feedback from it. But I generally don't recommend something like Matthew, doing 135 lessons straight on Matthew. But the material is always different, so my response would be, well, what's the problem? It's not the same sermon. It's different. But Matthew lends itself real well to nice bites. And, I know some have already talked about it and mentioned it, but one of the first bites that I would do, I'm telling you, if you go somewhere, one of the first sermons that I preach, one of the first sermon series I preach, is the Sermon on the Mount. It is one of the first sermon series I will ever preach anywhere. If you have not preached on the Sermon on the Mount, you need to preach on the Sermon on the Mount. I have 26 lessons from the Sermon on the Mount, so I cover in about 6 to 8 months. It depends on what my schedule is. And so it is so significant because the talk earlier about life in the kingdom, kingdom, kingdom. Well, the Sermon on the Mount, of course, you know, is all about the kingdom. Matthew 4:23, Jesus is going throughout Galilee, and he's preaching the kingdom. And so what it is all about is, what does life in the kingdom look like? I like what Dr. Alexander said earlier when he said, we really need to emphasize to people the concept of reigning and ruling. And that's what it is. It's, what does it look like? What does it look like when Christ rules me in my life? And the Sermon on the Mount answers that. And man, I'm telling you, if you go deep in there, it is just the demands of the kingdom, the transforming demands of kingdom life. And so it lends itself. But you can even break that up and do, the Beatitudes, 9 or 10 or 11 lessons on the Beatitudes. You got all the discourses, the 5 discourses in Matthew. I'm doing one actually now where I'm doing the miracles. I call it miracles in Matthew, and starting in chapter 8. And so kind of working on that now, everything cool?
Yeah, I'm just turning this off.
Oh. and then you've got the Olivet Discourse, and I love Doug's discussion on verse 34 there, the time text. And so it lends itself, pick something, pick a nice bite. I do recommend that usually more than a big book like Matthew trying to do it all at once. The fourth thing that I really think about is, and Kirk had it on his slides, not only do people want to go deep, most people really want something. Application, 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 application. 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 Okay. People do need application. And let me give you a for instance. If I'm doing a Sermon on the Mount, I'm in Matthew chapter 5, and we're talking about divorce. The biggest part of my time, first of all, I hit the reality of God's plan of one man, one woman for life. That's the plan of God. Okay? I don't spend all of my time dealing with a lot of the hypotheticals that come up in people's minds about that. I'll talk about that and I'll discuss it with people. But basically from the pulpit, then I get into application. And I'll even say this sometimes. I'll say, now, for the most part, now, what I'm about to say is primarily for the young people here. But it's also for you as adults, you parents and you grandparents. Don't say, oh, I can check out of here, because it's applicable to you now, because you have a moral responsibility, a moral imperative of passing this counsel on to your kids, your grandkids, and those in your sphere of influence. So this is applicable to everybody. But here's the application. Choose well. You've got one shot, usually. Choose well. And then I will spend... I will go through lists and lists of questions that I'll just throw out there that young people need to think about. You know, I mean, all the way down to, listen, you need to look at her aunts and uncles called crazy runs in the family. You know, I mean, how do they handle money? And we just go on and on and on, trying to help people understand that if they're going to embrace God's plan, they're going to let Jesus rule in their lives. And there's some demands there. And so how does it apply? Well, you choose wisely. And so application, application, application. Just a couple of more things that I really want to emphasize, or maybe just real quickly turn to Matthew chapter 8 real quick. There's so many other things, actually. I'm looking at this and I'm about out of time. I said that I'm kind of doing a miracles in Matthew right now. Kirk also mentioned this about making things come to life. And that's part of the whole digging deep thing. But as I'm working through Matthew chapter 8, let me kind of give you a very quick glimpse of kind of the last two sermons that I've done. And doing this little miracle series. And probably about 8 to 10 sermons. The first one is the latter, 4 verses. The cleansing of the leper. Went into the background. I really wanted to give people a sense of what it meant. I wanted to try to make it come alive, one of the things that Kirk was saying. I really wanted to try to make it come alive, and so I really spent some time discussing leprosy. I wanted them to understand the significance of leprosy, just how dreaded it was. Even talked about leprosy today. Then had some resources where some of the experts on leprosy really described it, and you really then got a sense of just how potentially horrifying leprosy is, and how grotesque it could be, and how terrifying that it could be, how alienating it was. Talked about it from an Old Testament perspective, and how it was alienating and resulted in ceremonial uncleanliness, and it alienated people from the community. And so as we looked at that then, what I did, now, you know, You can take the miracles and you can say, well, you know, the primary application of miracles is to demonstrate the evidence that Jesus Christ is who he claims to be. Because only Christ can do these things. And that's absolutely true. But I'm trying to make secondary application, because I do believe that it's valid application. And so I spiritualized that miracle and really try to help people understand a few things. That we really sin, we don't really understand, and a lot of people don't understand and embrace the significance of how horrifying and grotesque and how alienating sin is in our lives. And so we try to kind of make that parallel from this physical grotesque condition, alienating condition, to this spiritually grotesque, alienating condition. How are we going to be cleansed from it? And really, the approach and the response of this leper to Jesus demonstrates that. First of all, he recognized his need. He knew his condition. And he knew that only Jesus was the solution to it. He recognized his need. If we're going to be cleansed, we have to understand how ugly, how grotesque, how horrific, and how alienating sin is. We've got to recognize that need. I told about some people that I've occasionally studied the Bible with. You've been in this situation yourself where you'll go through, you'll study, they'll agree with everything, and they got it, and they just are not making a response to it. And people might say, hey, how's your study with so-and-so going? I'll say, well, you know, they get it here, but it's just not getting down to here yet. It's just not getting there. They don't really realize how grotesque their spiritual condition is and how alienating it is. This man recognized his need. We've got to recognize the need. The second thing that I did there was he responded to Jesus Christ with humility. He comes and he bows down before Jesus. And so there's this real sense of humility. Dr. Alexander said earlier, he emphasized how things in the Sermon on the Mount really intersect with everything else in the book of Matthew, and it does. You know, the Sermon on the Mount begins with fortunate are the poor in spirit. Those who are crushed in spirit, they recognize their spiritual impoverishment apart from God. Well, here you go. If you're ever going to have Christ rule in your life, there's got to be that sense of spiritual poverty, that constant recognition of our sinfulness, of our brokenness. And you see that demonstrated here as he comes to Jesus in his deep humility with his physical condition, bowing before Jesus. And then, finally, third, there is a confident expectation in the power of Jesus to make him clean. He doesn't say, listen, I've heard that you might be able to heal me. You know, there's some rumors spreading around that you've been able to do some pretty extraordinary things. My condition might be so bad, though, I'm not sure if you can do anything. There was none of that. If you look at him, his response is, if you want to, you can do it. An absolute faith in the power of Jesus to do what no one else can do. And we come to Jesus in humility, but we also come with this real confident faith. And it's only through that absolute certainty that Christ can accomplish what he promises that gives us any hope of cleansing. So that was kind of the first sermon that I did in this particular series in the application. But try to make it come to life. Try to make it really applicable. Spend a lot of time in study with quality resources. Kind of chip away at small bites, probably rather than taking on the big chunk. And those are some of the things that popped into my mind that I was thinking about. And I hope maybe someone who said been a little bit helpful. Thank you.
There you go, bro. The same thing he did. Is it on?
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, I can tell it's on now. Well, I feel like the old guy in this group. I don't know how old Barry is. But one of the things makes me feel so old is that I've known a couple of these speakers for a good part of their life. Doug, for example, how old are you? About 7 or 6, something like that, when I first became acquainted with you at Old Hickory. And Dan, on the other hand, I've known since he was about 2 years old. So it kind of really makes me feel old. And I said, you know, one thing is I know when they had hair. So that makes me really feel old. But I'm really proud of both of these young fellows. They've accomplished a great deal in their life, and I appreciate so much the good work they're doing and the good, solid foundation that they've built upon. Of course, Doug could be excused for some of his error because he heard me preach for almost 5 years. I spent about 4 years writing the commentary on Matthew, and like Dan said, I had all kinds of references. My desk, for example, was filled with books for those 4 years. Not always the same ones, because I had a lot of good references, fortunately, and I had all those books scattered on my desk for over a 4-year period before I could ever complete that book. But it was because I was working with a congregation of between 500 and 600 at that time, and so it required a lot of my effort and a lot of my time. But I thoroughly enjoyed studying, and if I learned anything at all, I learned how much I didn't know, and that was really interesting. I learned how much I really did not know, and I learned a great deal in the process of studying that text. I believe my main focus today, according to what Andrew told me, was to talk about teaching adults. And it's interesting that I began teaching adults when I was an 18-year-old high school dropout. I started preaching when I was an 18-year-old high school dropout. I did drop back in, but I began as an 18-year-old high school dropout teaching adult classes. Fortunately, I was preaching in a lot of rural congregations where people weren't very educated and that sort of thing. But I want to tell you something. I'm so thankful to those folks because they sit and listen to me. They even complimented me and helped me along, encouraged me to want to preach and want to get a better education so I could preach better. When I think about our congregations today, obviously, just as Rivergate is, we have a lot more educated people, but still we have a lot of people who are high school educated, don't have college backgrounds. And so I would give you a bit of advice. I know all of these things that you've learned today are so very important, and I think preachers need to know these things and study these things. But you don't need to tell your people everything you know. I never will forget when I was in my first master's program. I didn't realize, it was just kind of slipping in, you know, some of that theological jargon and that other stuff that we pick up. I didn't recognize that was getting into my lessons until my wife told me one day. She said, Sellers, you're getting over people's heads. She said, you need to get back to the KISS method. Keep it simple, stupid. And I really thought that was a good piece of advice because I didn't realize it was happening to me. I didn't realize I was bringing a lot of things into the classroom, into the pulpit, where a lot of those folks really weren't interested in. Now, are they interested in deep things? I believe that's true. But I think you have to take into account, especially when you're teaching adults, as we get older, our teeth aren't as good. And I do believe, and it kind of bothers me sometimes, we have people who've been in church for 50, 60 years, and they don't want to chew meat. But maybe we need to realize it needs a little tenderizing before we dish it out to them so that they'll have a better opportunity to understand it. I know there's so many things about teaching adults. And one thing is, I've written a lot of adult material over the years. I know we have people even today who are opposed to literature. I'm not opposed to it because I've written a lot of it. But I remember when I first went to Rivergate, I had written some books for Lambert several years ago, and they were actually on the high school level, supposedly, but I told Brother Gussie Lambert when he called me, Brother Lambert, I've only taught adults. I don't know how to write down. He said, well, you write what you know, and I did. And the young fellow who was teaching the book that I had written, one of the kids came to me and said, he tossed it up on the shelf and said, I'm not going to teach it. You don't need to know that stuff. So here's what I told him. Even if you use literature, if I'm preaching or teaching a lesson from something that I have written, I don't just get up and read the book. I sit down and study the book. And I teach a lesson from the material that I have written, and it may not be exactly like what is in the book. It may be different from that, mainly because I can't remember what I wrote. Somebody says, what did you write? I don't remember that too well. But I do believe that we need to be basing our studies in our classes as well as our sermons on the text. We need to stay with the text when we're teaching, and that's the best way to teach. But you have to be careful about verse-by-verse study. I don't know if Doug would remember this or not, but I did a verse-by-verse study on the book of Genesis. I was writing my own commentaries. I made a habit of doing that early in my ministry. I make my own commentaries when I'm studying the book. So they said they wanted a verse-by-verse study of the entire Bible. Well, if you're going to do that, you start with Genesis. And so I started with Genesis. 2 years later, we were still in Genesis. They wanted to do something else. So I don't recommend a verse-by-verse study. Teaching from the book of Matthew, teaching adults, I would suggest what some have already said, and that is that you take blocks of material. You take blocks of material. I do believe, I'm one of those who believes, that the book of Matthew was primarily a Jewish gospel. Not debating the fact that when it was handed down, it may have been handed to Christians, but I believe it was a Jewish gospel, and the purpose was to convert Jews to the fact that Jesus Christ was indeed the Messiah. Go back to chapter 1. What's the whole purpose of that infamous genealogy? It's to help them understand that Jesus Christ was a descendant of David, therefore the rightful heir to the throne of Israel. And those four Gentile women, you have to remember they were converted, I believe, to faith in God. But I like to dwell on that latter part of chapter 1 because the emphasis there on the fact that you have this young woman who is pregnant, she's unmarried, she's engaged, her espoused husband is ready to put her away, which he had to do legally as if getting a divorce. How would she be treated in society today? How many people would recommend that she have an abortion? Because she's with child, she's unmarried. And this would be an easy way of dealing with the problem. She could do it today secretly without him ever knowing about it. But we know if she had done that, then the Savior would not come into the world. And we can all thank God that it didn't happen that way. Dan mentioned the Sermon on the Mount. And I was going to talk about the Sermon on the Mount in a bit. And as we said, we're going to be overlapping. I understand that. But when I think about the Sermon on the Mount, I think about the Beatitudes much in the same way I do with the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are not the law. The Ten Commandments are the foundation for the law. And I see when you look at the Beatitudes, they're the foundation for the rest of what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. And I've always taken verse 20 as kind of being the title sentence for the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. Except your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so if you think about what he says the rest of the way through the Sermon on the Mount, and when he talks about it was said by them of old time, I don't think it has anything to do with the Old Testament writings. I think it has to do with the rabbinical writings, with the writings of some of those Jewish scholars. He's comparing that, which was the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, rather than being the righteousness of God as revealed in the Old Testament. And of course, it's just full of discussions about relevant issues and problems today. You can just continue to talk about those things because they're things that people can understand and relate to, and they can be helped by. I thoroughly enjoyed my study of Matthew when I was writing that commentary. But even today, if I'm teaching from Matthew, I go back and get my old notes out, and I get some other books there, and I begin to look at that material again and see if there's something else that I perhaps missed along the way. And I found out that even after 51 years of preaching and studying and teaching, that I can still learn a great deal because there's so much there. And I appreciate so much being asked to take part in this, Andrew, and I thank you for inviting me, and especially being with these illustrious fellows. It's a good thing to be around you and to learn from you, and I appreciate so much that. Thank you.
Well, I think for time's sake, I'll try to be brief so that we have time for some question and answers. But a couple things I do want to point out with especially young people, teenagers in particular, and the Gospel of Matthew is let me just go ahead and second everything Kirk said when it comes to a teenager. If you don't know anything else of what I'm about to say about a couple of things about Matthew, understand that most of the research today about the psychology of our teenagers has pretty well concluded, some may disagree, but it's pretty well concluded that their mental capacities, their ability to reason, their ability to process has matured greatly. It doesn't take very long to look around in the world that we live in. And a lot of our young people face things today that they never had faced before. Younger kids dealing with broken homes, younger kids dealing with violence, younger kids catching things in life that may not have been around in times past. Our kids are developed in a sense, mature-wise and mentally. And we need to approach them. If you've ever talked with a teenager and they've looked at you and said, "Quit talking to me like a kid." Let me go ahead and tell you, one of the greatest disservices we do is treating our teenagers as children. When they start getting past that age of a middle schooler, and good luck with middle schoolers, period. Being a youth minister, I got no help for you on a middle schooler's 6th through 8th grade. Good luck with that. I've been doing this for 10 years now, and I still have no answer for a 6th grader whatsoever. But it's amazing to me that some of the greatest acts of Christian maturity that I've ever seen have come from a 15-year-old on a mission trip. And I mean that. And there's studies in talking with another adult, and there's studies in talking with another teenager of being an example for Christ. Now, later that night in the church building that we're staying at, they may kick a football indoors that breaks a light fixture, and you have no earthly idea why they did that. But in that moment, though lacking maturity, their reasoning is incredibly high. I want to go ahead and tell you, there is nothing that I heard here today, even through our lectures, our difficult lectures, that there is no reason whatsoever that you can't share any of that with a teenager. When it comes to who Jesus is as the Messiah. Now, let me reiterate everything that Kurt said. You need to make it applicable. And you need to say how important it is. You need to tell them how important it is and how it connects to their life. But the idea of understanding the culture, they need to understand that there were elements of Roman culture then that very much parallel ours today. They believed in different gods with different belief systems and different cultures. They were a multicultural society. We are today. They get that. You need to understand that when it comes to understanding the greater issues of life, those have not changed throughout history and humanity. And so if you don't hear anything else of the next couple of things that I'm going to say very briefly, understand that when it comes to teenagers, don't hold back. Be applicable. Make the connection. Tell them how they need to live this out with their friends. But don't hold back. You need to tell them about the name of Jesus, what makes Him important, what makes those names significant. You need to tell them about these difficult texts. Yes, you need to teach them about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Unfortunately, they've learned too much about that from the wrong place. Mostly, for many of them, in their own homes. And at the end of the day, for us, that's what I want to tell you when it comes to a teenager. I can sit down with a 14-year-old and I can have a reasonable discussion with them as I can with you. Get them in a group might have to be a little bit different in its approach with the way that we connect. But let me go ahead and tell you, our young people, they need accountability. Oddly enough, we find with our young people, they want accountability. They want somebody to hold them to something. With a parent who just lets them turn on the TV and checks out, a parent who's doing 101 things, especially a single parent who may be just working the hardest that they possibly can to hang on. Your young people want an adult to engage them in a mature way. And oddly enough, how shocked should we be that yes, the Bible does connect with any of them? And so very quickly, when it comes to Matthew and these things, let me just go ahead and just say what we've said in all three of these. They need a healthy dose of the Sermon on the Mount. That was where I particularly did my master's work, was in chapter 6 of Matthew. But they need to understand this idea of the Beatitudes. Of this right here, to me, is a blueprint of a Christian. This is what they look like. Guess what? If you hurt, if you're sad, that's not necessarily a bad thing. All right, those who are peacemakers are who are found blessed. And on it goes. They need to understand, just jotting down a couple of aspects here of what you find in the relationship aspect of the rest of chapter 5. Are you going to tell me there aren't young people that need lessons, strong lessons on forgiveness, strong lessons on marriage, strong lessons on hate? Let me go ahead and tell you, we live in a hate-filled world. They're taught messages of hate through music, through culture, through society on a regular basis. It seems in such a small way what we can do to counter that. But that is part of what I feel like our job is. And chapter 6 obviously relates to a deeper relationship with God. And are you going to tell me there isn't a young person that worries? That worries about their family, that worries about their dad's job, that worries about their mom and their dad and they're arguing at night, that worries about college and life and the decisions that they make, an older brother and sister. Let me go and tell you, our young people are filled just as much as worry and doubt as anyone else is. And then of course, chapter 7 of just getting practical with faith. understanding false teachers, understanding flat obedience to God, understanding judgment, issues and topics that every teenager needs to hear. I love Matthew because of discipleship. That's a word that I particularly love. But images such as suffering that you find throughout that gospel, service that you find throughout that gospel, self-denial and taking up one's cross is real Christianity. What bothers me or what shocks me is when a teenager looks at me and says, "Barry, I see these things, I hear you teach these things, I see Jesus saying these things. Why doesn't our churches practice these things?" In other words, why do our adults not care? Yes, teenagers tell me that on a regular basis. And I tell them, well, we try to teach them too. But I try to inspire our young people, so many who leave the church when they go to college, to be that change in the future. Well, let's do this now. And I'm not here to espouse youth ministry in a huge way, but many of our models of, unfortunately, what's working in the world of a community church and how they grow so rapidly, I'm going to be honest with you, they're building their entire church on a youth ministry model. And our kids are leaving our congregations, and that's what they're used to. But when you look at the core of some of those places, they have a lot to do with service, which we want to emphasize service projects. They do have tons of mission opportunities, which we're big on mission opportunities. They love retreats. As you probably notice, many of your young adults love to get away too. Well, that carries over from some of the work that we do, whether good or bad. I know some people have different thoughts on that. But at the end of the day, it's times for us to sit down with and to tune out the world. I can't help but just mention and brag on my youth group. I wonder this is going to raise a lot of eyebrows, and I may get in trouble for this, but we don't practice Lent in the church. But a 40-day Lenten period is something that we've taken up in our youth group. And we choose beginning Ash Wednesday a couple of weeks ago, and we've got till Easter where our kids and our youth group give up something for 40 days. It's amazing to see a 15-year-old boy give up an Xbox or a PlayStation 3 for 40 days and to literally spend that time praying to God. They'll do that. That connects with a young person. This gets more real than just a Sunday morning. I've not yet had a girl or boy give up a phone, and a cell phone yet, and texting. But I'm hoping to get there. We've had iPods, we've had video games, we've had chocolate, we've had fast food, we've had prayers in the morning, we've had getting homework and all assignments completed on time. For 40 days, I'm going to turn all my homework in on time. A freshman in high school told me that. For him, that was a big deal, and I was happy that he at least could connect that aspect of suffering with Jesus and getting his homework turned in on time. For us, we may think that's small. For them, there's an element of Christ-likeness there that our young people can espouse that we need to feed into. And then lastly, very quickly, Matthew 24 and 25. I don't know of a single young person who doesn't need hope. The news has been filled lately, hasn't it? With our young people who live with no hope. And let me go ahead and tell you, this Jesus who just happens to be the Christ gives them hope. Gives them something to live for. Gives them direction. I'm not one that likes to just dwell on the judgment of God. I don't want to scare anybody into heaven. But not to quote a popular TV show and one Silas Robertson, fear can be a good thing. And I find that that's incredibly valuable, even for our young people from time to time. You know, for us, this idea of the end and of judgment and of Jesus fixing everything when it's all said and done, in whatever way that happens, what you and I need to understand is that for them that connects. Because they live in that broken world. I wrote down a quote from a scholar by the name of Donald Hagner, which I tried to get my bibliography. I got one of mine in. Somebody else had quoted it, but one of the others that has been very beneficial that wasn't was his two-volume commentary in the Word Biblical Commentary on Matthew. I thought was very valuable, especially when I did some of my master's work. But he has a new introduction, theological and literary introduction to the New Testament that came out a few months ago, and I was just reading through it, and this caught me when he talked about Matthew and eschatology, and he just simply said this: "The promise of future judgment and deliverance makes perseverance in the present both a possibility and a necessity." And I thought, you know, that's kind of a heavy theological statement. I'll read it again. "The promise of future judgment and deliverance makes perseverance in the present both a possibility and a necessity." But I couldn't help but think, if that's not a message a teenager needs to hear, a teenager needs to hear and to understand the future judgment where God will judge everything that's wrong. But then also the idea of our Savior who is a deliverer, our God who is a deliverer from the beginning of the Bible all the way to the end. presents not only a possibility, but how to deal with life, but also a necessity. And just as another note in that same vein of just the amazing bridge that Matthew is from our Old Testament to our New, to truly translate with our kids these Old Testament stories that they've learned on flannel board and bring those to life in the example and in the life and in the ministry of Jesus. Ed did a great job, and our other speakers, Doug and others, have done a good job of pointing out some of those Old Testament references for today of how they play over into the Gospel of Matthew. You can do that with young people too. Yes, the stories that you learned in Bible class have to do with Jesus and have to do with your faith. So with all these things in mind, I just want to throw these out when it comes to teenagers. Don't hold back. That's my biggest thing. Don't hold back. Don't hold back. Talk to your 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds as you would an adult. The things that you heard, take it in blocks. Don't lay out 40 weeks of Matthew. I do sections of teachings throughout Matthew with my teenagers, but I'll do Matthew and then I'll go to Acts, and I'll go to my system is Old Testament, New Testament for our text studies. But I'll come back to Matthew two or three times by the time a young person has gone through my classes from sixth grade through high school. But they get those different teachings, Sermon on the Mount or teachings or end times or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, don't hold back with them. Teach them as you would anybody else. Use the application. Interact with them. Use these wonderful methods that we have today. But don't be afraid to just sit down, open up a Bible, and talk to them either. And for that, I think we would just do our church and obviously the future of the church a great deal of good.